Welcome back to the show, Pompey the Great and the Fall of the Roman Republic, The Pirate Menace, Part 2.
Yeah, so I really think we really should start out this episode by asking, why was pirating so popular? You know? And I think the reason why pirating is so popular is because once you lose your first arm, you know, you're hooked to life.
Jesus.
I wanted to do a series of, like, corny pirate jokes this entire episode, but I couldn't really find a whole lot of good pirate jokes that didn't just have a lot of R's and stuff in it, and I's. But, nevertheless...
I feel like there's a joke here about you couldn't stand on it, or what is it? I feel like there's a joke here about standing on one leg.
Yeah, or...
I lost it.
Yeah, some kind of peg-legged, based humor. I don't know. Oh, man.
But to our listeners, we're sorry about the delay in releasing the second half of the so-called pirate episodes. You know, we're going to have this episode out in the next couple days, and then next week we're going to release a very interesting mini-series about the history of Roman warfare, which we think is going to last three episodes, however long it takes. And we'll take a small break from the linear history and we'll cover that. So that's always an interesting topic for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we left off last time. I think there was some violence in Rome. Gabinius had proposed giving an imperium. He passed a law wanting to deal with the pirate menace, and I believe it was a thinly veiled ploy by Pompey to basically get the pirate imperium to deal with the pirates, which he was obviously assigned.
Right. This in early January of 67. Like you said, Gabinius had published a proposal to make Pompey the commander of the pirate menace. Though he was fully aware of the Optimate opposition, so he took his proposals directly to the people, as Tiberius Gracchus has done. And I just love saying this, I'll say it again. And if it was not apparent before, it was now that the final reforms of Sulla had been undermined forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did we say that Gabinius proposed that the people should choose from the ex-consuls a commander whose power would last for 3 years, have power over the Mediterranean and Black Seas, including the coast up to 80 kilometers?
Yeah, he when Pompey was finally appointed his imperium, and there's some debate on what type of imperium he actually have. He basically sectioned off the Mediterranean into 13 different sections, and he assigned his legates. He was given free choice of who he wanted to assign as legates, and he basically sectioned off the Mediterranean 13 sections and assigned each section its own legate. And then he took command of at least 60 ships, and he cut it into halves at the Sicilian Narrow between Sicily and Africa. And so he first went to the western area to deal with the western area and to sweep. Supposedly he swept clear the entire area in 40 days. He drove these detachments of the enemies into the arms of the section commanders. And so in this way, he kind of went section by section, clearing the western half of the Mediterranean. And as the pirates fled, they fled into the eastern half, and that's when he slowly began driving them into an area called Kilikia. And I think it's interesting to note here, you know, who he actually appointed, because he was given the ability to appoint legates. Actually, gave him quite a bit of political influence, because these people that he could appoint obviously would go on and achieve higher and higher commands, as we know. Obviously, ever since the time of Marius, perhaps a little bit before, the Roman military had become more and more corporatized, and you could actually climb the ranks with titles. So both of the censors of 70, Lentulus Clodianus and Gellius Publicola, accepted posts, as did one of the younger Metelli, Nepos.
Now, we kind of breezed through part of Gabinius's proposal. The command did allow Pompey to choose 15 legates, right? And he could also draw as much money from the treasure and from the taxes collected abroad to fund his campaign. And he can raise as many troops and ships as he wanted. There was a little bit more squabbling there politically. And I didn't know if he wanted to go into it or if...
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you said Gabinius was violently attacked in his speeches by the consul Calpurnius Piso. And even hinted, if you emulate Romulus, you will not escape the same end as Romulus. You mentioned that in the last podcast.
Oh, okay. So. Yeah. He basically, there was, it was basically the same command. Basically, the Gabinius had suggested to the Senate that it should choose one of the ex-consuls for supreme commander against the pirate allies. And put at his disposal sufficient forces and lieutenants to enable him to cover the whole Mediterranean simultaneously. This was basically the same command that was given to Antonius in 74. And if we go back, we'd even see, Marius, was kind of plotting with one of his, political allies to kind of secure this, pirate post as, almost a stepping stone to be appointed war in the East. I think this is kind of the reason why we look at Pompey and we see him moving from fighting the pirates in the East or fighting the pirates in the West and driving them to the East, because obviously he wants to end up in the East with all of his troops and not in the West, where obviously Lucullus is now currently proceeding against Mithridates, which the East is considered to be a very luxurious, very wealthy area that is pretty much ripe for the pickings. But if we look up, who Gabinius was opposed by, he was opposed by the consul Piso, who also later opposes Pompey during the actual fight with the... He's actually opposed during the fight with the pirates, and Pompey actually has to go back to Rome to deal with Piso, because Piso was dismissing a lot of the troops that were levied for Pompey. But at this time, Gabinius was opposing, along with Hortensius. I think we've talked about Hortensius, the famous orator, who was kind of the most famous orator before Cicero.
The dancing man.
Mm-hmm. And so what happens is Gabinius took his... He basically called an assembly of the people and put his measures before them, and perhaps with certain elaborations on the scale of command, which he envisioned, but without naming any particular commander. So he basically alluded to, which obviously we've seen this before with Pompey, it's kind of like a... He wants to say it, but he doesn't, he wants to come right out, but he doesn't want to make it seem like it's the will of the people when it's actually, just clever propaganda. But basically the people start crying out for Pompey, and, when they heard that Pompey's friend, one of the favorite tributes, had nearly been killed by the Senate, they rush into the Senate house with such violence that they basically almost kill Piso. You know, he was almost killed. He was basically caught and dragged out into the forum, and he was only saved when Gabinius intervened to save Piso from the mob. So we see this is almost the I think this is the first time since really the you know, the violence of Metellus and Sulla that we really see political violence returning to Rome. And this is all in favor of Pompey. And you also have, you know, Hortensius speaking against these proposals. Obviously, Cicero mentions that Hortensius spoke against these proposals. And, you know, we see Plutarch further indicating that other senators have made similar speeches, with the exception of a certain Julius Caesar who, quote unquote, cared nothing for Pompey, but sought always to ingratiate himself with the populace. So obviously this was a very, popular movement to appoint Pompey to take care of the pirate menace. We can obviously see that as soon as, Pompey was, appointed under the Lex Gabinia, there's such a confidence in the populace of Rome that the corn price immediately dropped. And I think if you see, you know, nothing had really changed, you know, Pompey had not even prosecuted it yet, but there was such confidence in Pompey that the corn price immediately dropped. So he was an extremely popular leader, and we now see Julius Caesar kind of starting to ingratiate himself, with Pompey, who was now the kind of darling of the populace, the savior of the populace, the latest incarnation of the strong man in Rome.
You know, Pompey has this really great speech here from Cassius Dio, but it's really long, and even Catulus, according to Cassius Dio, relents and gives a really, really good speech in Pompey's favor. Do you have it in front of you by any chance?
No, I don't.
Well, I could just paraphrase it. You know, so, you know, Catulus eventually stands up and basically,
you know, he says, you know, if, you know, what would happen if Pompey were to perish and everyone starts cheering that he would become the commander. Basically he makes a pretty good point about, you know, Rome not really grooming any further military commanders, so they're basically putting all their eggs in a single basket. Yeah, so that's kind of the gist of that speech.
And you know, Pompey is widely criticized for feigning a reluctance to take the field for the sake of Rome, and we've mentioned this countless times because it's in the histories of Pompey. Says, you know what, I'm tired. I want to be with my wife. I want to retire. I want to move away from the city. We kind of see this again with this Gabinius thing. You know, he's not there. He leaves on the day of the voting. Instead of waiting anxiously, he kind of disappears from sight. And he's kind of criticized for, you know, being kind of falsely modest and acting like he doesn't want these extraordinary commands. But of course he does, if he's not directly manipulating the political arena behind the scenes, which is kind of an odd criticism because Pompey easily could have just bulldozed his way through every command he's ever had after the death of Sulla, but consistently he doesn't do it. And he would have had an overwhelming ability to conquer, get what he wanted from the political elite at Rome, and Caesar bulldozes his way to what he wants by the skin of his teeth. And you know, it's really remarkable that Pompey is basically in the situation that Caesar was in at the Rubicon, more or less, again and again in his career, and he never acts on it. So, you know, the criticism that he feigns reluctance is a little ridiculous.
Yeah, and here's I found the that speech that Catulus gave, and I'm just going to read a small excerpt from it. He says, yes. Then again, there's a consideration that entrusting the war to one man deprives many individuals of the opportunity to gain the practical experience that will make your choice of men who can be trusted with any future business an easy one, since you will have made the trial of their abilities. If, on the other hand, you persist in your intention, there will inevitably be a shortage of those who will give themselves the necessary training and be available for command. This is the principal reason why you are at a loss for a general in the war against Sertorius, for you have previously kept employing the same men for long periods. Therefore, even though in all other respects Gnaeus Pompeius deserves to be elected to command against the pirates, I maintain that insofar as he would be chosen contrary to the principles of both law and experience, it is not right either for you or for him that this should be done. And he goes on, and he gives some other reasons why Pompey shouldn't be elected. They should elect someone else. And he finishes up with, "Then finally I beg you to spare a thought for Pompey himself. His task as a virtual monarch over all your possessions will not be free from envy, as he himself admitted. And have you considered what would happen if he failed in this enterprise? Do you wish to risk his life in the war against the pirates? Great as he is, he could fail, especially in sea battles, which are notoriously unpredictable. And if he did, what other man would you find to take his place for any more urgent tasks which may arise?" And that's when Catullus finished his speech, and a thunderous cry came out from the throng of people, and it said, "You, Quintus Catullus, we shall have you." That was kind of the end of his speech. Catullus kind of ducked out. He didn't want to be in that position, diametrically opposed to such a dangerous adversary such as Pompey, who is now in the position to take supreme command over pretty much the entire troops, all the troops of the Roman Empire, more or less.
And I think it was a force. Mm-hmm. I don't think there has ever been a larger force in the field except for maybe what was commanded under Sulla.
Mm-hmm.
And politically, it was masterly maneuvered, and it's very contrary to the aloof politician that Pompey's painted as working behind the scenes is the essence of politics. I mean, look today, like even in like the election coming up in America, and you know, we don't have to get too into it, but it's not enough to be a politician and say, "Look, I'm really honest." You don't know. You got to create the contrast between you and your opponent. Not only am I very honest, but Luke is a vicious liar, and he lies all the time, and I always tell the truth. You know, so you're not just bringing yourself up politically, but anything you're opposing, you diminish as much as you can behind the scenes. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And I think you can also, you also see a great deal of that in the Roman court system, where it's not so much a question of evidence, but of just character attacking. You know, it's almost a without, you know, that's basically the tactic in the court, is just attack character, attack character, attack character, you know, pull out some surprise evidence, you know, and then just attack character, attack character. It's almost becomes like a show. And it's very much, that's how their political, life was, and that's how their, sort of legal constitution was. It's just kind of, theatrical in a sense, which, you know, I guess the same could be said about, you know, really our whole, system of justice and politics and so forth. There's definitely a large, especially since the advent of, television and the internet, you know, I think we're definitely seeing more, spectacle based politics in America today. Which is would not be foreign to a Roman individual.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was nothing new to them. It's nothing new to us. You know, you have a politician who has a political agenda to say ban armed men in the streets, you know, and there's a lot of opposition to this. And then, you know, during this debate, a bunch of terrorists, you know, or would-be assassins, strike up violence in the city. And then they say, look, see, right there. That's what I'm talking about right there. You know, is it coincidence? Is it maneuvering? You know, we're always going to have that debate, you know, so, there's definitely some masterly maneuvering here on Pompey's part. And of course, when the time comes for him to accept this command, he says, well, you know, it's always with modest reluctance. Well, if it's for the good of Rome, I will take this amazing opportunity to vastly enhance my wealth, patronage, and clientele across the Mediterranean and all of Asia.
And this wasn't an entirely, this campaign against the pirates, it's not an entirely cocked thing by Pompey. This had been going on for quite some time. You know, we had, I think it was around, 99 or 100 when Saturninus passed a law to help, Antonius in his war against the pirates. This law that Saturninus had proposed, basically closed all the harbors of the empires and allied states, and mobilized all the forces to fight the pirates. And this was the first time we kind of see this, law kind of take place. It, basically, Saturninus was conspiring with, Marius, to basically give Marius a dictatorial position in the East, and sort of a dictatorial position, which Marius could arguably, have been one of the first strongmen, since Scipio Africanus, since Rome started turning to these strongmen after the defeat at Cannae, where Hannibal, basically destroyed and devastated the Roman military. They turned to Scipio Africanus, who basically saved Rome from the war. And now we see Marius kind of laying out this plot. Obviously Sulla, the next strong man, came in, and now, we're having, Pompey, who's now again flirting, with illegality, to assume, positions that are really, counter to the Roman constitution.
Yeah, in his career, it is occasionally illegal. I guess we're going to get into that, but, even if it's not, you know, Pompey does, though he may not do it in quite the fashion Julius Caesar does, he does continually undermine the Senate. And, you know, it's kind of a double-edged sword. You know, Pompey shows the ability and the techniques to undermine the greatest house of authority in Rome. And it also shows on display for the whole world the Senate's reluctance or inability to react. You know what I mean? And it's not just the political maneuvering. During the Lepidus affair, somebody had to take control because the Senate was just dragging its feet on the best way to do this. So, you know, they have a lot of shortcomings too, but as far as Pompey's role goes into the inevitable, destruction of the Republic, if he's not partially, you know, if he's not directly responsible, he is definitely poking holes or revealing the weakness in a government infrastructure that has no ability in its own to take care of the Lepidus revolution, the revolt of Sertorius in Spain, and now the pirate menace. You know, the seas are absolutely choked with pirates. Mm-hmm. So,
I mean, Rome, lost in the Punic War, 3,000, I think it was, 300,000 men in one battle due to storms. Because they thought they could just battle the elements of nature just the same as they could battle, people. They thought if they were tough enough, they could withstand any kind of storm, and obviously they lost, a great number of people during the Punic War. So, Rome had always been, uncomfortable. The Roman Republic had always been uncomfortable with sailing, because it was such a treacherous, and uncontrollable, unpredictable, venture at that point. They didn't have really any weather forecasting. They basically relied on soothsayers, and goat entrails, reading goat entrails and the birds in the skies and different things like that. So,
yeah, winter was absolutely the worst time to sail the Mediterranean, because that is when we have rains, that is when we have storms. And the rest of that winter was spent mobilizing. Plutarch gives the figures of 500 ships and 120,000 men and 500 cavalry.
Mm-hmm.
And Pompeii was ready by early spring, even before the seas were suitable for sailing. As I said, winter sailing is not the time to take a boat out for a spin. And the pirates had control over virtually the entire Mediterranean.
Right.
The pirates also were cooperating closely and concentrating an attack on any one area.
Right. Obviously, there's perhaps some sort of, we're also told there's perhaps some sort of collusion with Mithridates, and there's some sort of, there perhaps even, there's some sort of alignment with the cult of Mithras, because the cult of Mithras, was kind of a religious cult that had sprung up, in the East. Mithridates almost, fashioned himself as a reincarnation of Mithras, who famously slain a bull, and the kind of metaphor that it was putting out is that the East was going to take retribution. And I think we went over this before, that East was going to take retribution. Mithridates was going to come and slay the bull of Rome. And that he was going to take over it. So, even when you had Pompey and Metellus Pius fighting Sertorius in Spain, we had Sertorius supposedly colluding with Mithridates, and Mithridates sending some pirates to aid him in the war in Spain.
And some Roman officers apparently were sent by Sertorius to aid in the training of Mithridates' troops.
Yeah. So, the pirates were obviously, we're told, were more than just a ragtag group of people. They had, at this time, pirate captains that were similar to, generals. They had ships that were equivalent to some of the biggest ships that Rome had. So they obviously weren't just a small group of people. They were a large interconnected network of guerrilla fighters on the sea.
And Pompey obviously realized that if he was going to fight these pirates, he was going to have to try to keep them separate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so we had talked about how he separated it into 13 different operational areas. And since, we on this podcast like to get into detail, I'd like to go into a little bit more detail on these operational areas and some of the legates that he had. Of the 13 areas, we talked about how he started in the west and moved to the east. 6 of his operational areas were in the west, 7 were in the east. He started around the Straits of Gibraltar, the very farthest east, and he assigned the east coast of Spain and the Balearic Islands to Manilius Torquatus, while the straits themselves, together with the whole of North Africa, Africa coast all the way to Libya, was the responsibility of Tiberius Claudius Nero, who was required to patrol the Atlantic coast of Spain around Cadiz. He then divided the northwestern Mediterranean east of the Balearics among three different legates, of whom Marcus Pomponius was assigned the south of France and the Ligurian Sea, Publius Attilius to Sardinia and Corsica, and Lucullus Gellius to the west coast of Italy itself. That only left Sicily as the as the source of corn, which basically was Pompey's lifeblood to feed his popular support. Yeah, so that was assigned to Aulus Plautius. So that was probably the most critical command, and it was assigned to Aulus Plautius Sicily. The 7 legates who were assigned the eastern commands, it was Lentulus Marcellinus, who took over the took over responsibility from North African coastline south of Sicily and controlled the area from Libya east towards Egypt, the Adriatic coast of Italy down to the heel. Probably went to Lentulus Clodianus, whose authority then was yielded to Varro, who was the famous scholar who had wrote Pompey's guide to the consulship. Varro was assigned the Ionian Sea and the western coast of Greece. Yeah, this was the same guy that kind of wrote that sort of cheat sheet for Pompey to look at when he was in Rome doing his politics. He apparently performed so well in the war that he was decorated with a naval crown. So he not only was a scholar, he was decorated war hero. Further east in the most critical regions of the Levant was assigned Metellus Nepos. Obviously, there's that Metellus connection. Metellus Nepos was probably given this critical command due to Pompey's connections with the Metelli family. The Metelli's Nepos probably wasn't... he was probably there just as a holding spot to get him some experience so that he could advance more quickly and fulfill his position within the Metelli family as perhaps a consul later on, which I believe he does become. I'm not sure of the exact year. This was basically, he was assigned Lycia, Pamphylia, Cyprus, Phoenicia, which is a pretty huge area. And he was not, he was told to perhaps, or it is suggested that he was not assigned Cilicia, and he had, which was sort of the epicenter of where the pirates were from, which is in modern day Syria, I believe. Syria, Turkey. So the remaining three commands all were the Aegean area, where basically the three commands were given to Lucius Sicina, Lucius Lollius, and Publius Piso, who patrolled the west and east and north respectively. This area is kind of the area between Greece and Turkey that has the, you know, a number of islands, and would probably be a hotspot of pirate activity at this point. This was the sort of layout of Pompey's troops. Obviously, it was a large area, but by breaking it down into smaller areas, we can obviously see he was able to clear out these areas really well.
I'm really amazed by this, and I hope that everyone is paying attention to that layout. And in fact, if you're listening to this, everybody who's listening, send Luke Murphy $5 right now for that. We only get these figures from Appian and Florus, and only nine, and there are only nine commanders that are similarly named in both these accounts. So it's a little hazy historically how this campaign was perfectly laid out. And of course, each commander was to defeat, the respective pirates in their area of command and only pursue them to the edge of their individual territory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they weren't allowed to go over because, you know, and this obviously makes me think of, you know, obviously we have sort of groups, you know, similar kind of quote unquote terrorist groups in the Middle East today. And I wonder if, you know, what the general, I wonder what some of the generals in the Allied fight against, say, ISIS would do. Similarly, I wonder if they do, you know, I haven't looked into this, but I wonder if they have cordoned off, you know, say sections of Syria, Iraq, you know, and these areas and assigned to each of them an individual who's responsible for kind of fleshing out, you know, the activity in the area. You know, I don't know if that would be politically feasible in our modern age to kind of, assign troops like that to the ground. I know there's obviously a strong reaction against sending troops into these areas, but it's very, to me at least, it's very similar to what was going on in Rome at the same time, or at this time.
It's odd that Pompey isn't given much credit to this. I read in one biography that if you know, if anybody had the resources at his disposal, he would have done the same just as well. Well, you know, the fact of the matter is the seas were virtually cleared of pirates within 6 weeks. So, you know, let's keep that in mind. And three other commanders have spectacularly failed before Pompey finally, you know, finally pulled up his bootstraps and took care of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, he obviously goes, supposedly, you know, after he clears most of the Mediterranean, he's kind of, leaves Cilicia open so that all the pirates kind of retreat into this area where he can put on the final coup d'etat. We're told he ends up going to Rhodes to consult with a philosopher, a famous philosopher before this. And what he kind of learns from this philosopher, or we don't know what they talked about, but his final coup d'etat moment with these pirates happens where he takes all the pirates who surrendered and gives them has these cities built for them and has them populated in these cities in sort of a way recognizing that really their poverty drove them to kind of become pirates, and that by establishing cities where they could live, it was would obviously give them, you know, good life, and they would turn from piracy.
Now, when Pompey first clears the sea in the west and the land there, he does meet some resistance in Gaul. Some weird resistance in Gaul? Did you want to talk about that?
Would you want to?
I don't mind if you want to add. I don't have a lot, but our friend Piso, the consul from the year before, is cataclysmically governor in Gaul, and there he's opposing Pompey's recruitment of men. And according to Plutarch, Piso even goes as far as dismissing some of Pompey's men. So Pompey, next when he sails down the west coast of Italy, he lands in Etruria and he proceeds overland to Rome. And Gabinius, that fox, has been waiting in Rome, and he had measures prepared to dispose of Piso's command. But oddly, Pompey doesn't take this step, and I think it's reasonable that they must have settled with Piso once he learned which way the wind was a-blowing.
Right.
And it's also interesting that we have no sources of this arrangement or why Piso stepped down his hostile actions. And I think that's pretty interesting that he suddenly stops.
Yeah. And I think, you know, if we look at the same thing in Dio, we see that Dio only mentions an attempt to prevent enlistments inside a Transalpine Gaul. So he might have been using his consular authority to demobilize crews already raised for action in Italy itself, which might not have really been necessary at this time because obviously the pirates were on the run. So it may have just been a political maneuvering, but we can probably be assured that Pompey and Gabinius had put it into it so that it wouldn't happen again.
And Florus tells us here that Pompey's two sons, Gnaeus and Sextus, got their first taste of military service here under Lentulus Claudianus. And his son Sextus, ironically, I don't know if I want to spoil that about his son Sextus and the later Civil War and his war in the Civil War with Antony and Augustus. I don't know if I should save that or give a little spoiler.
Yeah, well, you can save it. It doesn't matter. I mean, I think we got enough to go in here. But obviously once, you know, not to belabor the point, it's an easy battle. You know, he bottles up all these pirates around Cilicia, Corcesium, which is a bay in Cilicia.
And his brother-in-law, Metellus Nepos, was instructed to patrol the coast of Lycia, in Cyprus, Phoenicia, but he was to leave the port of Cilicia open.
Right, yeah.
And so like you said, the pirates kind of bottleneck.
So, and I think it's important to note that this Metellus, you know, there was also the Metellus Critias, who was given a command before Pompey to deal with the pirates in Crete, which after this leniency, most of the pirates in Crete want to surrender to Pompey because he is supposedly more lenient. Metellus Critias, this is a different Metellus who's assigned to Crete, becomes very brutal in his persecution of these supposed pirates, and he basically butchers a lot of the people of Crete at this time, and basically Pompey sends one of his legates to accept their surrender, but Metellus Critias doesn't recognize this this surrender, and basically Pompey's subordinate has to he basically leaves the island, and it becomes a fiasco. But this could probably be seen as one of the most pivotal points where really the Pompey and the Metellus start becoming at odds. And obviously the Metellus were, you know, the family of prominence that really gave, you know, basically wives to Pompey, and basically married him into the family under Sulla. But now Pompey and the Metelli are starting to butt heads for power. I think obviously Pompey, by assigning, or by taking in, a Metelli, Nepos for, one of the most critical, actions in the war. He was obviously trying to give them an appointment or, bring them up. But I wonder how much of that was him complying with what the family requested of him by appointing this individual, or how much of it was he was actually looking at this individual's ability to wage combat. I don't know. That's all speculation.
I'll tell you what I think. Before the pirates are bottleneck near Cilicia, when Pompey sailed from Brundisium, when he leaves Italy with that whole Piso affair, he travels through Athens and he crosses to Rhodes, or he picks up more fleets that he had instructed to wait for him there, etc. And he meets Poseidonis again. I think you mentioned this, right?
The philosopher, yeah.
he attends one of his lectures. He has time for a little philosophy. And before he leaves, he asks Poseidonis for any advice. And the philosopher answers with a quote from Homer. Do you know what the quote is?
No, why don't you tell us?
Yes. So Poseidonis answers with a fabulous quote from Homer. And he says to Pompey, he says, "Always be the best, my boy, and preeminent above all others."
Yeah.
So that is the advice Pompey took, and that is why he started falling out with.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's probably the. Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah, that's sure. Why not? You know, I mean, what
like Pompey needed to know
what
that.
Are you gonna, what kind of advice are you going to give to the most powerful man in Rome who has an army at his back? You know, I mean, you know, as a philosopher, what would you be? You know, what could you give to? What advice could you give to him? It's probably just, yeah, please don't kill me, and you are the best, you know? Yeah, he sets up these areas in quote-unquote rugged Cilicia. So he sets up these homes for the pirates. Obviously, this area, basically these cities are named Pompeiopolis, and it was supposedly adorned with impressive buildings, and supposedly it became a rich and thriving city, in which there was no temptation for piracy to return. And although we're told that it's kind of this idealism of him, you know, basically taking in, I am kind of reminded of that, I think it was what, Solon who had an eye poked out. This is an ancient, just sort of a Greek, almost a mythology where there's a, or it was Lycurgus the lawgiver, supposedly had an eye pulled out by a young man who was attacking him. Lycurgus, instead of, seeking retribution against the young man, took him in, and, made him into a model citizen. And so for Lycurgus, that was justice, that he was able to take a young man who hated him so much that he was willing to attack him, the best of the Greeks, that he took him in and made him a better man. And this was more just than retribution, because he was able to improve the society, improve this young man's life. And so I think in a similar way, we have Pompey sort of doing this, same sort of Greek, stoic, maneuver, with the pirates. But, I think we can't be too, I think this starts to become some, part of Pompey's, sort of state building in the East, where he's basically setting up these cities, so that he can, maneuver in and around the East and stage, his invasion of the further East. So this is what I think Pompey is doing. And I think that's why Pompey is probably one of the best generals, that Rome has seen in a long time, because he's actively plotting for war. He may not have been the best, perhaps even tactician. And I think there's we should make a difference between, tacticians and, generals who command and, build and designate different areas. I think obviously, Pompey being, I think, a wise general, here is setting up areas and infrastructure so that he can come in and, engage further in the East.
So he also has a reputation for being undefeated, more or less, and also has and in this case, a very apparent reputation for generosity and mercy, which I think is a pretty good tactic in itself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so that's basically what happens with the pirates. And obviously, when Pompey goes back, he goes back to Rome, he begins to receive a triumph from Rome for his conquest against the pirates, and Metellus Critius also gets a triumph. But what happens is Pompey, the two pirate kings that surrendered to him, he removes from Metellus Critius's procession, so that he's not allowed to have basically the pirate kings that he took in Crete. So this is basically a huge slap in the face to Metellus Critius, who worked so hard to defeat a single island when Pompey basically conquered the entire Mediterranean. So I think next time we'll get into basically what Pompey was setting himself up for, which is to become the general supreme in the East and basically start gaining untold wealth in the East.
I also wanted to add that Plutarch tells us that 20,000 pirates surrendered, and that most had been drawn to piracy because of the difficulties of making an honest living. So the pirates were settled, especially in underpopulated towns of Cilicia. The town of Soli was renamed Pompeiopolis. So we have a few of those springing up across the world. Some monuments of the city still remain, but for a time was a major city in Cilicia. So to sum up Pompey's campaign, the western area of the Mediterranean was cleared in just 40 days, and the eastern side in 49 days. And there's a lot of ancient hyperbole about how the seas were never again choked with so many pirates, because Pompey had so permanently eradicated them. Though, we have Cicero bitching about it just a few years later, is about pirates. And when Galbinius is governor some years later in Syria, he meets some problems again. And ironically, Pompey's younger son, Sextus, becomes a terrible pirate threat during the civil war between Augustus and Mark Antony, which we'll cover down the road. But long after Pompey dies, his son becomes a sea force to be reckoned with. So those are just a couple things I just wanted to add. Yeah, I think that pretty much covers it for the episode 2 of the Pirate Menace.
Cool. Yeah, thank you guys for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you.